and gore, and sometimes a little more. My Bloody Podcast.
Hello and welcome to My Bloody Podcast. We have an excellent show today. It is November. It's almost Thanksgiving. We survived Halloween. I don't know how. There is so much candy. There's even leftover candy on this table. But we're here to talk about horror movies today, and we have a very, very special guest. Before that, I'm Brian Kluger, and I'm here with, oh, as always, Preston Barta, the good, sweet-smelling man. How are you? And we're in person, finally.
Yeah, this is a big breakthrough for us.
Yes, very excited. But our special guest, he is like, he's the legendary filmmaker. It's David Lowery. You've known him. He's award-winning. He has new movies out right now. You can see him in the cinema. But you're from Wisconsin, right?
Originally from Wisconsin, yeah.
But you grew up here in North Texas,
I moved
right?
To Dallas when I was 8 years old.
That's awesome. And in Wisconsin, I'm curious because I've been to Wisconsin, Milwaukee,
yeah,
or Whitefish Bay, or
my grandparents are from Milwaukee, and then we grew up in a suburb called Waukesha, which
okay.
is famous now for Slender Man related. Tragedies.
That's not funny, but I know exactly what you're talking about. And I've been to Summerfest in Wisconsin. I love
Oh, yeah. That was an old staple. Yeah. My parents would drag me there. I just wanted to go not be there, but I remember getting dehydrated and having to go. A long story.
But we're all glad to be here in person, in the flesh, for My Bloody Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. But today we have a great show. We're going to talk about the original 1963, The Haunting, as well as the new Netflix show, The Haunting at Hill House, amongst bloody questions, bloody recommendations, and other things. But Preston, what do we start with? What do you want to start with?
I guess I want to start with your introduction to horror, because I know that when you and I talked before we did the Old Man the Gun Q&A after the screening, you had mentioned that horror is your favorite genre, so I'm curious to know how you got into it.
I think it was through the Universal Monsters, and when I was growing up, both in Wisconsin and here, there were like a series of books at the library that were like these Universal Monsters books like that were orange, like they had black and white covers, like photographs on the covers, and then like orange binding, and they were, I've looked them up on eBay, and they were super expensive, but there was like a series of like children's books. You know, basically storybooks, you know, telling the, you know, recounting the tales of each of the Universal, you know, Studios monsters. And so there's Dracula, Frankenstein. I was always terrified of the Wolfman one because mm-hmm. the fortune teller, the gypsy fortune teller, the photograph of her was like incredibly haunting. And so I always like my mom would have to paperclip that page together so that I wouldn't have to see it. But I just checked those books out of the library over and over and over again. And I had a natural affinity for Dracula because I fancied myself as a Eddie Munster style young vampire. I had like a little widow's peak even at a very young age. And so I just was like, oh, I look like Dracula. That's my favorite. But I also loved Frankenstein and Creature from the Black Lagoon. And so I think that was my introduction. Like even before I wanted to make films, I was really into those books. And for a period of I'm going to guess about a year when I was like 5 or 6, when people asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I would say Dracula. And from there, you know,
was that because you wanted to live forever?
No, I just thought it was cool. I don't even know if that was part of the equation for me yet at that point. I just thought he looked cool.
Awesome.
Bela Lugosi looked awesome. I love the idea of him living in a castle and having a cape. It's important to note that I grew up without seeing these movies because we didn't have a TV or VCR when I was growing up. And so I just learned about them all through books. And I had a couple other books on movie monsters. And then I would go to the video store, or not the video store, the grocery store with my mom, which at that time in American history, the grocery stores would have a video section in them.
Right, right.
And so while she was shopping for groceries, I would just browse the aisles of the video section and just always wind up in the horror movie section. And as we all know now, like, you know, in the 80s, horror movie VHS art is, yep. It's a much beloved thing now. But at the time, like, it certainly did its trick. It worked on me. I just always just poring over those titles, looking at them, imagining what those movies might be like. And then, like I mentioned, Ghostbusters was something that my parents did finally let me watch relatively early on. Absolutely freaked me out.
There's scary moments in that.
Really, like, the opening movie in the library. Yeah. Like, that is really, I don't know if I recovered from it. In fact, I don't know if I saw the whole thing. I might have gotten too scared. I think I saw the whole thing, but definitely that freaked me out. So it's just something I've always gravitated towards. And as I've matured, I kind of just realized at a certain point that I never have more fun going to the movies than when I'm going to see a scary movie. And when a movie satisfies you that much, it must mean something. So at a certain point, I was just like, yeah. Horror movies are my favorite genre. Easy.
No, I totally agree with that because, you know, there's something about being scared and having fun with it. Like when I have nightmares, when I'm asleep and I wake up, I'm like, thank God I'm alive. But I'm happy to have that nightmare. Like I prefer those.
I prefer them like a day later. Like in the moment, I'm just like, oh my God, I don't ever want to go to sleep again.
Yeah.
I'm scared. I get scared really easily. When I go see any horror movie in the theater, 90% of the time, I'm only seeing 40% of the movie because my hands are in front of my eyes.
Right.
From a very young age, I'm very easily spooked, and that has not changed. And so it's very perverse that I enjoy horror movies so much and that I go see them and I seek that out. But and it's different from I love going on roller coasters. I love the thrill of that, but horror movies get me on a deeper level. It's more than just a thrill. It's something about being unsettled on a physiological level that somehow appeals to me.
Yeah, and I think you also connect with characters and the story and probably related.
Sure.
Yeah, I that's why I love it. I put myself in that situation, and I definitely get scared in horror films where as much so that I have to sleep with lights on or have to watch like something like Seinfeld or Scrubs afterwards.
So right, yeah, yeah.
Yes.
And I don't know, like there's something also like even the bad horror movies are enjoyable. There's something about the genre that make, like I was talking to someone about Halloween recently because Halloween is on everyone's mind right now. And like that's my favorite slasher character. Like I love the Halloween series. But really, there's only one good movie, and now we're two. Let's say there's two, 2.5. And now we can maybe say there's like 3.5. Mm-hmm. I rewatched H2O because I remember really liking that, and I wanted to see if it held up to the new one. And parts of it do, parts of it don't. But really, like, you've got Halloween 1 being so, it's so good that it just, the goodwill from that carries over through all of the other bad sequels. And I think 2 is okay. I think 3 is great, but not part of the continuum.
Correct,
so obviously
yeah.
You just set that on its own. And then you've got from, you know, Halloween 4 all the way until the new one, which has, there's what, like 6 movies there? Like, yeah, because you've got 4 through...
4, 5, 6 with Paul Rudd, 7, H2O, Busta Rhymes, 8,
yeah.
And then the Rob Zombies, yes.
And they're, most of those are just terrible, but I still like them. I mean, I haven't seen all of them, but I still like them all, the ones I've seen.
No, we've talked about Halloween quite a bit on the show, and we are always trying to figure, like, what are the best ones? What are the worst ones? Why do we not like these? But there's something universal, even bad horror movies as opposed to maybe bad comedy movies. You'd never want to watch a really bad comedy again, but you'll watch a bad horror movie again.
It's really weird, yeah. I mean, and there's a certain aspect to which they're just objectively poorly made because they didn't have enough time or money. Like, you look at the first one, it's really well made.
Yeah.
You look at... the new David Gordon Green one, and it's relatively like exceptional in its filmmaking,
mm-hmm.
regardless of like some of the plot points people are taking issues with. It's like really well made on a technical level. But even watching H2O recently, I was like, it's not that well made. I mean, it's like kind of like a CW show.
No, right.
In terms of production value. And it's, and even like, you know, famously that mask in that one is terrible.
Right.
And it's like, how did they look at the monitor on set and just think like, okay, we got this.
Now watching that movie specifically over again, the scene where she kisses him, where she kisses Mike Myers.
Oh, yeah.
Did that hold up or does that like, oh.
Wait, she kisses him?
I think so, yeah. When she's about to die.
When she falls.
Yes, right. Correct. Like on the lips.
I must have like looked away. I must have like gone away. Like I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, that does happen in H2O. In I remember H2O? That. Yes. It was, yeah. You remember that, right?
Mm-hmm. But she kisses her brother?
Yeah.
So it's a weird incestuous thing.
Right, right.
Because at the end they have that beautiful moment where he like reaches out for her.
Yes.
Before she decapitates him. I must have just like looked away when she kissed him because I don't remember that at all.
They did the Star Wars thing, I guess. There.
Yeah.
Was there an intro to horror for you too, Preston? Like, do you remember? Because I know recently you really, really got into it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the Friday the 13th films. I was that kid that hooked up, like, I had my 19-inch TV that I bought from Kmart. And then I had, like, my smaller one that used to be hooked up into my parents' car because we didn't have, like, a built-in TV to the car. So we just brought in, like, the one that had the VHS player in the TV. So I took that out of the car and hooked it up to my TV that had a VCR hooked up to it. And I would go to Payless Video and rent, like, Boogeyman, Friday the 13th, all the Nightmare on Elm Street films, and then just watch it on one and record it on the other. And I just had a collection of all the handwritten VHS.
Was this on a tube TV?
Yeah.
Badass.
Love that TV.
Yeah. I finally bought a TV in high school when I had got a job, and I remember watching, I saw Halloween maybe a little bit before them, but I definitely like watched it in my bedroom. So every now and then my parents would rent a TV and a VCR. So maybe at one of those points I'd watched it. But it was on television, so it was edited for TV and had commercial breaks. But because I saw it, like, because that was like the first slasher movie I saw, I think that's, in addition to being a really good movie, that's why it endeared itself to me. And I was just like so excited. It was like airing on channel 33, like 4 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. I was like, yes, finally going to see Halloween.
It is awesome. I love watching that. I think my intro to the horror was, I was 6 years old. My parents were big movie fans and they brought me to see Aliens, the James Cameron version. Mm-hmm. I loved it. I was scared, but I loved it. I came home that night and I went to bed and my dad put my mother's pantyhose over his head, kind of like the tentacles, and he crawled on the floor and like scared me while I was sleeping in bed. And from then on, I was scarred, but very happy.
My dad would do stuff like that, like irrespective of movies, like, cause we didn't watch movies, but he would definitely like hide under the staircase and like make spooky ghost noises. Uh-huh. And I'd be like, whatever, that's dad. Then he'd like walk out from another room. It turns out he'd been recording. He'd recorded himself. Nice. And put the tape recorder under the staircase. And so I remember like things, pranks like that would definitely, and also growing up in Wisconsin, like we all knew about Ed Gein and
yes, like that, yes. So. Man, which is the,
I'm putting that in my bank for my son when he gets
I was six, I think, cause it was 1987 when Aliens came out. So I think it was 5 or 6 years old, something like that. But yeah, you should keep those because always fun. It warped me and I'm turned out, I think, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, the intro to horror. So favorite horror movies, or even better, like maybe some of your favorite scenes from horror films that have always stuck with you.
I mean, just since we were just talking about Halloween, just the one thing that I missed in the new one was that moment in the original where he's walking from one porch to the next. He like walks across the street and just keeps cutting back to him. He just is walking and she's trying to unlock the door.
Right.
And that's one of the most terrifying moments in horror movie history, just because he just keeps coming. It's that one wide shot and he's very small in the frame, gradually getting bigger and bigger with no change in speed or menace or anything. It's just like that is so well done. And of all the things they pay homage to in the new one, I was like hoping they'd have a moment like that, which they don't really, which is whatever. They don't have to pay homage to everything, but that's my favorite moment from the original.
They did everything else.
Yeah.
No, that's I strictly remember that scene because I always love when like the continuity of actually still seeing him and not disappearing, but like, oh God, he's really going to get her.
And you just know he's going to get right up into the lens at some point.
Yeah, like, right.
At some point he's going to be right up in that lens and you just feel that very palpably, like the fact that he's getting closer.
And I think we've all been in that situation when you're at you're somewhere and you see somebody creepy across and it's like, I got to get inside now. Mm-hmm. And that's a great
scene. Yeah, there's something about people just walking towards you that is terrifying. I mean, Night of the Living Dead, the original, is all that. Like everyone's just like always walking towards you.
Right.
And just getting a little closer, like in the cemetery in the beginning. That's something that's really creepy, especially if they're not like moving quickly.
Yeah, and that's a good point because in Night of the Living Dead, you know, you kind of can outrun them. Mm-hmm. But you can also kind of outrun Mike Myers in a way, I guess.
You could, yeah.
And even like, you know, punch him and he'll fall down, but he'll always be back there.
Or a roundhouse kick him.
Yes.
Unless you think about Behind the Mask's logic.
And oh, yes.
They can walk at an incredible rate when the camera's not on them.
All the training
that they do.
What about you? Favorite scene from a horror movie that stuck with you?
It probably was the opening scene of Jaws.
Yeah.
I bring up Jaws still a lot on this podcast because even as a 28-year-old man who owns a pool I can't swim alone in my pool.
It's not, I saw it for the first time like 2 years ago.
Jaws?
Because I just, it always been like, oh, I'm going to see it on the big screen. I kept putting it off. And finally, like, I think the Inwood showed it at, you know, 4K restoration. And so I went to see it. And it was great, really. But it did not scare me one bit.
Yes.
However, like, the technical chops that were on display just like blew my mind. Like that one shot where they take the ferry from one side to the other and they have an entire dialogue scene. I was like, that's amazing. I can't get over this shot. And, but it didn't scare me.
It did. I guess the first scene, I think we all, maybe if we've ever been in the ocean, always have a fear of like, oh God, something will take me like that. Mm-hmm. But I'm so glad that it scared you so much that you don't swim in your own pool. Very happy about this.
Yep.
I don't like being in the ocean just because it's big, you know.
Because, yeah, you have no idea.
It's just like, it's less about the sharks or other creatures in there. Just like the scope of it really freaks me out. So a movie like Dark, what was it called?
Open Water.
Yep. Yes.
Like that one. The sharks were fine. Like, that was scary. But the scary thing about that was just the fact that there's just
nothing around you.
That's what's existentially frightening about oceans to me. But I always say, yeah, I never had that fear of, you know, water that Jaws gave people because I talked too late, or showers that Psycho gave people because I was like, well, the door is locked. No one's going to get in here.
Yeah. It's, oh, good. I guess my one that I always remember that always scared me was Child's Play. When the mother, Annie Barclay's mother, looked and he was talking, there's no batteries in him, and yep. He threatened to throw him in the fire, and he just turns on her. I was like, oh, shit. That's scary.
Yeah.
That is so good. And then, that scene is so great, how they, like, the tension that builds when she looks under the couch and everything like that. And, oh, I love that. I love it. There's so many good horror moments.
Yeah, though. I mean, there's like, we could talk all day about favorite horror moments.
But let's move over to horror soundtracks. What makes a good horror soundtrack to you personally? Is it like the use of synth now, or is it like hardcore punk rock? Or
I mean, it just depends on the movie. I mean, there's so many good horror soundtracks. Like, one of my all-time favorite scores is Bram Stoker's Dracula by Wojciech Kilar.
Mm-hmm.
I'm mangling that name, but it's an amazing soundtrack, and it goes from being very elegant, very romantic, very sensual, to being so horrifying that it actually has, like, wolf snarls mixed into it. And it's one that we always just play kind of a loop around Halloween in our house, just because it's really nice, atmospheric, and it covers all those bases. Like, it's got sweeping romance. It's got an Annie Lennox song at the end, which sort of kills the horror movie mood, but it's also really frightening at times. Another one that I love is Danny Elfman's Sleepy Hollow score. Like, mm-hmm. I think that's really phenomenal. And again, kind of like has that romanticism to it, that dark romanticism, but it does get really intense and scary. But I also, you know, Suspiria, the original Suspiria score is hard to top. Like, that's like,
it's Goblin, right?
It's Goblin, yeah. And that's like a truly excellent score, really out of the box. Like, some of the, like, the clacking percussion that is on there is really unsettling. And it, of course, like, we all know, like, the main theme and the incantation of which actually literally as part of the lyrics of it, but it is some of the other tracks on that soundtrack that really get under your skin. And then, yeah, Halloween's great. You can't go wrong with that, which I think was influenced by the Suspiria score. I think so.
Yeah.
They got a very similar like motif.
I love all those. What about you? Is there one that sticks out to you soundtrack-wise?
Outside of, like, the normals of Halloween and Jaws, just the music working as a character. But I guess recently, probably It Follows.
It Follows?
Yeah, yes, disaster piece of score. I got the Nicholas Winton Reference Presents on vinyl for the It Follows. And so it's not really one that you want to just play casually in your own house, especially around your wife. So I listen to it when I'm writing about horror or writing about a horror movie as kind of like inspiration for words.
Yeah, no, I like that. I really gravitate towards like the actual songs, kind of like Return of the Living Dead that I pulled out over there, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 that has like Rocky Erickson and the
Jason Lives,
Alice Cooper.
Yep.
I love that stuff. I don't know why, but I guess if I would do a score, like The Shining maybe, Andy Warhol's Blood for Dracula, and probably Nightmare on Elm Street, just because I love that. Do, 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 do. And you mentioned Halloween 2 earlier. I love how they really amp the synth up on that one to 11.
Yeah. And there's like, I can't remember if he used Penderecki in The Shining, like on the score, but like Penderecki's classical music is terrifying. Like it's really like, David Lynch has used them as well. And that it's really fun to like go listen to these classical composers who make really frightening, like orchestral, you know, symphonies that just really kind of like disturb you to the core.
Yeah.
With no movie attached to them.
Yeah, no, they're all great. And I think I always love, like, if I listen to it, I always want to play chess to these scary scores, these haunting scores. And I always thought, like, Tom Waits, I think One from the Heart was the only soundtrack he did, but I always thought he would do a great horror soundtrack.
Oh, yeah, a very jangly horror soundtrack.
It would be.
He did Night on Earth. He did the soundtrack for that.
Okay, so, he did? Okay, yeah. That's right. I always thought, like, his voice and, like, just the weird instruments he would use would be crazy to have, like, in a horror soundtrack.
Yeah.
It would be fun. But, yeah, horror soundtracks, let us know if we missed any. But I think we're on to our bloody question. We ask a fun question, and we got to answer it. We've done, like, if you were a zombie, what type of zombie would you be? Would you be slow? Would you be fast? Would you throw up on people? But today's bloody question, Preston, what you came up with this?
I took it from the 1963 The Haunting. There's a line in that film where it says, "Whose hand am I holding?" And that line always got to me. So I thought we'd kind of go off from that. And so what is the creepiest line from a horror movie that stuck with you?
That's a really good one. It's always like those things about like where something that you assume to be true turns out not to be true. Like something like that. I'm terrible at dialogue. Like, I don't ever remember lines from movies. So I was racking my brain, and I was trying to think of things like that. Like, you know, that's not your daughter, or that's not your son, or, you know, they're in the house. Like, where it's just someone's established idea of reality is proven to be untrue in a truly chilling fashion. But I couldn't think of any. I was like, what are they? But that's one of them. That's a great one. I watched the movie not too long ago, and, like, that line really, like, gets you.
Yeah.
The one that I always go back to is in Lost Highway when he says, "I'm inside your house right now," and that's like such an amazing sequence.
That,
unsettling.
That's always scary because I think like they've done that before in other films, kind of similarly, like the calls coming from inside the house, type of thing, and that's always scary. Always scary.
Completely.
Like in Scream.
Yes, like in Scream.
Then the other line I was thinking of was in Rosemary's Baby, which is like, what'd you do to its eyes? Just because you don't see it.
Yeah.
And that's just like, that really, when you don't see something, you hear someone say something as evocative as that, it really gets you.
Yeah.
Like, that's like, you're just like, oh, no. I don't even conjure a mental image. It's just like that line itself carries so much weight and terror.
Those are really good creepy lines. What about you, Preston?
Pretty much a lot of David Fincher's work. There's quite a few in Seven, but the one that got me the most was in Zodiac, where the lady that's driving in the car with her baby, and then the potential killer pulls up and then asks to change the tire or fix the tire for her and loosens it. He has to pick them up and drive them to the station. And he says, "I didn't know that there was a baby in the car." And she's like, "Is that going to be a problem?" It's like, "No, more the merrier." And then as they go down the highway a little bit more, he says, "Before I kill you, I'm going to throw your baby out the window." And the way that line kind of ends, there's kind of a buzzing. Like, because like even Fincher recognizes that this line's probably going to stun people and shock people. So that line always got to me. And then probably another one was in Danny Boyle's 2007 Sunshine.
Oh, okay.
It's the point where a lot of people either hate or love the movie even more. And this, from it going from like a sci-fi film to a horror film in this very moment, made me love it more. But I don't remember the line verbatim, but it was just, there's not enough oxygen to sustain, you know, allow the passengers to survive. And so says, "Well, we should, because there's four people." It's like, "No, there's five people." And Pinpacker coming into the situation and then making the movie take a sharp turn into horror always got me.
Yeah. That's a great movie. I actually love Sunshine. I love that film. I have a few of them. couple short ones.
Your mother sucks cocks.
In hell. Oh, yeah. I was going that way. Let Jesus fuck you. That was another one. No. They're here. Carol Ann and Poltergeist. Mm-hmm. Who's here? The TV people. That scared me because a kid or a dog knows more. Like there's some, mm-hmm. see something yeah. like I've got to move out. I'm out. I can't do that. Another one that really got me, M. Night Shyamalan's movie Signs with his cameo. And he's talking to Mel Gibson and he's about to pull off and he goes, "Don't out open my pantry door, father. I got one. It's locked in there." I'm like, oh shit. That I remember like in the theater, like sweating and like this on the handrails, like this is not happening. And then he goes in there and,
that's a great scene. I like that movie a lot.
I love that movie. Yeah. I thought it was like so scary, but that line is so creepy. And I think another really good one is the end of Silence of the Lambs is I'm having an old friend for dinner. Mm-hmm. And like, that's one of the, well, I guess not one of the few, but you root for the bad guy kind of there, I think in Hannibal at least.
Yeah.
And is Soylent Green as people? Is that a horrific, creepy line that you know that you're eating people?
I've never seen the movie at this point. That line is like pop culture to me.
Okay.
And so
okay.
It's like, I'm curious like if the movie ever had like horror movie significance. I have not seen it. I don't even know what happens in the movie other than that.
It's interesting. It's more like a ew kind of thing. Earnest. Yeah.
They're eating me and oh wait, they're eating her and now they're gonna eat me. Oh my god.
Oh funness. But yes, if we're missing any creepy movie lines, please let us know. But on to bloody recommendations. It's where we usually give like either a new or an old vintage horror movie that you may have forgotten of that we want to suggest that you need to watch this again. But David, what's your recommendation for everyone? I'm curious.
There's this movie that I saw a couple years ago that just scared the shit out of me, and I recommend it all the time. It's called Lake Mungo, and it was made in 2008. And it's an Australian movie.
And they make great horror films.
And it's a faux documentary, which normally, like, red flags go up for me, but this one really terrified me. And it is sort of like capturing the Freedmen's meets... Oh, just like, I'm trying to think of like a good ghost movie comparison, like Paranormal Activity or The Conjuring. Like, it's really like, tells a story of this family in documentary form that a tragedy happens to, and the supernatural begins to, like, play a part in it, but you're never quite sure how real it is, and they do a really excellent job of just creating this mood of this sense of dread, and you don't often get that from documentary or faux documentaries. Usually it's more about like the Paranormal Activity style where you're just getting jump scares, and this is all about this deep feeling of unease and dread and fear that just creeps over you. And I just had so much trouble sleeping for a week or two after seeing it, and the images in it, like, I don't want to ever see the movie again because like there's certain images in it that aren't that scary, like if you were to separate them out from the movie, but in the context of the movie just are so deeply unsettling that I just don't want to experience mm-hmm. that again. And my wife watched it. She wasn't scared by it. She thought I was like, just like being ridiculous. But I've had other friends who found it equally as frightening. And so it was made in 2008. I think the director's name is Joel Anderson. It was definitely being developed for an American remake for a little while, but that hasn't come to fruition. And it's great.
What is it called again?
Lake Mungo, like M-U-N-G-O, which is a big lake in Australia.
Okay.
So Australians would know what that title means. Americans are like, what the hell is that?
Lake Mungo. That sounds awesome. Would you describe that as capturing the Freedmans and like Conjuring or Karen? That sounds amazing to me.
It's really, it's really weird, like freaky. Like it just keeps evolving. Like over the degree of terror keeps changing over the course of the film.
Wow. Now I want to go see this. Can we get it here?
It was on Netflix. It might still be on Netflix.
Okay.
Like it was on Netflix for years and years. That's how I saw it. And
okay.
It's definitely on Blu-ray. And the cover is like very, you know, like a rather like evocative shot of like a woman drowning. And that's like, it doesn't suggest the fact that it's not a documentary at all. And not really indicative of what the movie you're about to see is. But it's a you probably recognize it when you look up the poster art.
Okay, okay. Well, Lake Mungo. That sounds amazing. All right, my bloody recommendation is a film, H.P. Lovecraft's Dagon. Have any of you seen this film?
No, everyone had. Came
out. Yeah, I think it came out in 2000, I believe, and it's directed by Stuart Gordon, produced by Brian Usna. But this movie is insane. If you're into horror movies and you're looking for something kind of new, Dagon is for you. It's about two couples who are on vacation sailing. Their boat crashes. Two of them are trapped on the boat. The other two go to the village for help, but it turns out everybody in the village are kind of like mermaid creatures, but like satanic ones who praise the Dagon, who is this giant like octopus creature who wants like virgin sacrifices. And it just goes from there.
All it's like this Wicker Man with Cthulhu.
Correct, correct. It's like that, but maybe with a reanimator type of gore, because there's gore everywhere, but there's also like voodoo and ritualistic satanic stuff. And it is super, super fun. It's made well, and you just won't see anything like that. Like, it's very rare to find a movie that has a bunch of like mer creatures in it, mermaid creatures, merman. But yeah, Dagon, please, highly recommended. If you're into Amazing. The gore and mermaid creatures, super fun. And it's on a Vestron Video, which they're kind of like Lionsgate Scream Factory collector's editions. So they put out some fun stuff. So find that, Dagon. Preston, what's your recommendation, good sir?
I'm going to go with the original 1956 Invasion of the Body Snatchers. All of Films recently put out this disc, and I love their packaging on these films. Like, they put, like, me and my buddy were really into slip covers. Yeah. Like, they have to have slip covers.
Well, David, you mentioned a little bit ago that horror art is like a big thing now.
Yeah.
I mean, there's like books now, like of like collecting all the 80s VHS art.
Right,
and,
right.
And the ones that you usually remember the most are the either horror or science fiction ones.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. That's good. I'm glad that came out, because that is great artwork.
And another reason, kind of going off of the theme of this week, since we're going with like the original film and then the new series, but, I tend to be most fascinated by watching the older films of, ones that have countless remakes. I've seen all the remakes of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and I like them. But I think for the time that this film came out, and how you can kind of take the whole film as like a Cold War allegory, and the effects at the time, and just the fear that everybody had at the time that this film came out, kind of when you have like real life issues kind of working their way into a horror film, they tend to stand out more for me. And so diving into this, and then they have like a lot of great features with Larry Cohen.
Yes.
And Joe Dante, and they kind of dissect the film during like a Q&A portion, like the inspiration that they took and how they brought it into the films that they make. But I'm just a sucker for black and white films, which is why I like The Haunting. There's just like a certain quality that you get from these films that you don't necessarily get today. And so just the things that they can accomplish at that time really stand out to me today. So and for a 1956 film, it really holds up really well.
How many – they've done several remakes of this, right?
Yeah, and there's the 78.
That's the Donald Sutherland one, right?
That one's great. That's the iconic ending.
Yes.
And then
there's the Daniel Craig one, which was just called The Invasion.
Oh, yes, that's right. I blocked that from my memory.
It was like ghost directed by the Wachowskis, if I remember correctly. Right. Like that. Yep. And then, then the Abel Ferrara one is really interesting, from like 93, I think.
Yeah.
I wonder why that movie's been remade so much. Is it just...
It's just culturally relevant. Cool. Like, you can just apply it to any time period. Yeah, it's sort of like Star Wars Born. You just, like, every 20, 30 years, you're going to get a new version of it.
Yeah, I guess so. There you go.
Well, kind of like going off the idea that we were talking about earlier, just, like, somebody following you or like not knowing their true intentions is truly terrifying.
So right.
I think they just announced a new one.
A new invasion?
Yeah.
For 2018, 2019, 2020? Oh my gourd. Another one.
Look it up.
Yeah, I looked that up. I'm very curious to see.
I think it was like with a filmmaker attached. And it was like, I remember when it was announced, I was like, oh, that's interesting. And I was like, it's only been like 9 years since the Nicole Kidman one.
Yeah. Is it, was it a decade ago? Was it that long ago?
It came out right after, after Bond.
Oh, wow. So I wonder who will be the next guy. I wonder if they'll actually bring in somebody from previous versions, like Donald Sutherland.
Like a Suspiria
Maybe
style.
Kiefer Sutherland will show up. I don't know. But yeah, I'm curious to see if they'll call it Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Yeah. Has there ever been sequels or have they only been remakes?
Only been remakes.
Yeah, only remakes.
Interesting.
It's one of those titles that I feel like is like, I'm down with that. Like I'm happy to have like a dozen versions of that one thing. It's like it's evergreen enough that I'm always interested to see what another filmmaker will do with it, although I never saw the 2007 version.
The Nicole Kidman one. I completely forgot about that.
it barely came out. It did not do it very well.
Is it one? I wonder if it was because it's just called The Invasion and not The Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
I think they were trying to do something different with it, because I remember like they had like some pink goo that they would take off their face, and that's how you knew that they were pod people.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm trying to remember it, but I think I only saw it once.
Yeah, I saw it that one time in theaters, and that was it. But it's really interesting that this original was directed by Don Siegel, who did Dirty Harry.
Yes, which is also really good. But yeah, Invasion of Body Snatchers. I'm excited. Yeah, I always look forward to see like what other filmmakers will do with remakes and how they apply it. Any luck?
I have not found it yet, but it's just like on Wikipedia, they just have all of the... Seems they have like a page just for the title, but they don't just each individual movie.
There's 500,000 Invasion of Body Snatchers
exactly,
movies.
Exactly.
But yeah, we'll move on. And while you check that out, we'll do our main events. We'll start with The Haunting, the original 1963 version, not the 1999 version, which I fondly remember watching in the theater. But The Haunting, directed by not exactly a lightweight, Robert Wise, who I guess edited Citizen Kane and did West Side Story, Sound of Music. Earth Stood Still and Curse of the Cat People, which I think I've talked about recently.
Star Trek Motion Picture.
Yes, the original one, that Robert Wise, I mean, one of the greatest. But he did direct The Haunting, and oh man, this movie is so good. And I guess what I read was that Robert found out about the book, The Haunting, post-production of West Side Story.
Yeah, I think he was reading an article about it, and then he got the rights or asked to get the rights after he read that article, didn't read the book yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, and we'll get to the other topic in a little bit, The Haunting of Hill House, which is on Netflix, but this is kind of the first thing we've seen on film, I think, of that story that is so popular right now.
Have you, either of you read Shirley Jackson's novel?
I have not read the novel.
I would love to at this point now that I've spent the past month just like diving into both versions of it. This is also must be one of the earliest like classical haunted house movies that, you know, I mean, obviously there were plenty in the early days of cinema.
Right.
This is like the first big, studio one?
I think so. I think
I don't remember when 13 Ghosts came out.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember when 13 Ghosts.
That would have been like more like the B movie. Like this was like an, like a big classy director, like a classy yeah. production.
Yes. With like
didn't
good.
Didn't have the disreputable qualities of like a William Castle movie.
Right, right, right. With like all the gimmicks. But no, this was like centered on, you know, like good characters and you like felt for them. And then you not only just see the haunting, but like their emotions and like their troubles in the film, which I really, really like.
I mean, you've always had that. I mean, even going back to like, what was, what's that one that Criterion put out a couple of years ago that was like one of the earliest ghost films? And it's actually got really great effects.
A Carnival of Souls?
No, it's like un something. trying really to good.
Okay.
I can't believe I'm blanking on the title.
I'm trying to
I'll answer the phone here and just ask. I was just texting with someone about it yesterday, so I can go through my text and find it. But it's, you know, there's always been, you know, going back to the beginning of cinema, these, you know, haunted house movies. But I feel like this was like the first time that you had a big studio classy, you know, release with a big director mm-hmm. doing something that didn't feel like it was just a B picture that happened to be good, or a comedy like The Ghost of Mr. Chicken or Topper or something like that.
Right, mm-hmm. right. It felt more, it felt serious, like, you know, in a good way, I think.
I think the scares are more felt than they are shown.
Right.
Oh, definitely, definitely. It's called The Uninvited.
The Uninvited, oh, yeah.
Okay. 1944. Really good.
The Uninvited, yes. Yeah, but The Haunting, it's, I think it's just how it plays out, even for back then, I think it's still, it could be put out today. And I really like it. What do you bring most from the 1963 version?
I mean, they really, the house, the idea of the house being the source of the evil, which mm-hmm. is like one of the key things in the narration that ends the film, which is, of course, pulled from the book, that the house itself was born bad. And mm-hmm. I love that concept. I love the idea of a physical space having a spirit to it. And you certainly get that in this movie, although I was very interested to go back to it and discover that you can watch this movie and just assume that nothing supernatural actually happens. There are moments where everyone seems to be seeing something.
Right.
But the true scares in the film all have a logical explanation.
Right. They do. They do. And I think that's even scarier in a way, because is it your mind? Are you going exactly. crazy? And, you know, or what if this is all, there's another plane trying to come through.
And I think it's really smart. Like, there's that one moment where the door seems to start to swell as if something's pushing on the very fabric of existence, and everyone sees it. And it's a shared phenomenological experience. And so you assume in those moments, okay, this house is haunted. Everything that is, you know, everything that we've been worried about is kind of come true. But then the rest of the movie, all the scares are very literal. You know, you can kind of like add them all up. They all make sense. The wife disappeared. She was like trying to get from one place to another.
Yep.
And you really can explain it away as being, you know, nothing supernatural. And yet you've got that one moment where everyone saw something that just keeps that possibility open. And I love it when those possibilities stay open, when there's no concrete proof, but yet you can't quite shut the door on the supernatural. And that's sort of how my own relationship with ghosts is. Like, I can't explain them, and logically they make no sense to me, and I shouldn't believe in them, but I keep that door open because it just makes life better.
Well, you made a horror film, and did you bring anything to that from Haunting into that?
I mean, I don't really consider it a horror film, even though it employs the tropes of the genre. Uh-huh. I wanted to like use the language of horror films to make something that wasn't a horror movie, although certain people find it existentially terrifying. I don't really think of it as a horror film. And that's why I really want to make a horror film someday, because I haven't scratched that itch yet. but certainly, like, you know, that movie exists in a very literal way. Like, it's a ghost story. Literally. It's like about a ghost. There's no question about it. And so for me, you know, it's not playing that line at all. I don't necessarily subscribe to what I'm laying forth in a ghost story, because there's just a guy who becomes a ghost. Mm-hmm. And I don't really think that's what happens. But I do like the idea of energy hanging around after we're gone and infecting a space. And I don't know why that would scientifically occur.
Yes.
And maybe someday we'll be able to explain it. Maybe we won't. But I subscribe to it.
Yeah, and I like what The Haunting does, and what they explain in the film is that even though, you know, it's a house that's evil, but also it serves as for good for people, I guess, to see loved ones, or kind of, it's kind of like a graveyard for them, I guess, is what I thought.
Kind yeah, of like that a never good goes well.
A good and bad sort of thing. Yeah, I guess so.
Is there anything in it that you didn't like upon revisiting it? That didn't hold up well today?
No, I mean, I was really impressed with how modern the whole thing felt. I mean, I don't think this movie you couldn't get away with it now. That's why the new version, The Haunting of Hill House, like, is so different. This is such a slow burn. It would be an art house movie. You'd need something more. You would need something to hook audiences the way horror films hook them now. I don't think the 99 version had the right way of doing that. I remember seeing that in theaters as well, and just the moment the giant statue like drowns Liam Neeson, I was like, I'm out of this movie. Like, like it doesn't, it's not scary. Like,
well, yeah, it seemed too silly.
There's
yes,
no rules.
Correct.
Like these things, like a giant statue comes to life, or the angels
right.
and the banister like all start talking. It's like when that stuff starts happening, it ceases to be scary because it just breaks the rules of reality. But the best ghost stories always like dance along the edges of it.
Right, right. No, I agree. I remember seeing the 1999 version, and then just I thought after it, I was like, man, the trailer was way better than this whole movie was. Because the trailer looked really good, but then when you get into the film and you're in, it's like, oh man, that really wasn't scary at all.
And I have a sneaky feeling that the VFX would not hold up one bit today.
Oh, no.
Especially like a little girl in the curtain floating around. Like, I remember even then, like, doesn't really. It's hard to get scared when the VFX look bad.
Right, right. Yeah. It takes you out of the whole thing. But yeah, the Haunting 1963, very good movie, but they actually kind of redid it in a very big way on Netflix called The Haunting of Hill House, based off the same story. And they did 10 episodes. And how they did it, what's that guy, Mike Flanagan?
Yeah.
Directed all of them, and which was a great move. And, like, visually, story-wise, always thought, like, it was almost, like, 6 feet under type of, like, story and family. And with this supernatural thing over it, because I really got invested with those characters. And I think it made that much scarier.
I just want to say Mike Flanagan's really exciting.
Like, yes.
I think he just keeps hitting him out of the park. I thought Gerald's Game was incredible.
So good.
I Ouija 2
was
fantastic.
Great.
Oculus. I haven't seen Hush, actually. That's the one. And then I finally saw Before I Wake, which was a long-lost movie. Very similar to The Haunting of Hill House in terms of the way it starts off as like something that's truly scary, but ultimately winds up just being more emotional.
Right. And I think he's adding that emotion to it, and that you can tell he really cares for the genre and his characters, not just a cheap jump scare.
Yeah.
And oh, it works so well. Like, it was one of those few TV shows where I was like, I have to watch all of it all at once because I need to see what happens. And when it was over, I was like, please make another one with these same characters because I'm not ready to let them go yet.
Yeah. He does it perfectly. His first 5 episodes, you get to know each one, and then when they all come together for the second half, you're like fully invested in them, and that and their journey is more important than the scares, which aren't that there aren't that many. Like I told my wife, I was like, you don't have to be worried about this. There's not that many jump scares in it. You'll see like 2 or 3 per episode, and you get the idea of what they're going to be pretty early on. And what really matters is like
this one.
I was going to bring up, there was one jump scare I think is like the craziest jump scare to me ever. And it was when they were both in the car
and I think it's like when the film, cinematic language level, the intensity with which their conversation was ratcheting up and which
right.
he was not paying attention to the road,
yeah.
you knew something was going to happen. So of course, automatically, I'm just like this. So I knew something was going to happen, and listeners cannot tell, but I'm just holding my hand in front of my eyes. And you start to pick up on like the clues that a jump scare is going to happen. I thought it was going to be she was going to be in the road.
No, I thought it was going to be a car hitting or something.
Yeah, you just know something's going to happen, but like, that was not what I expected.
Oh, yeah. I jumped on the couch, and I was like, I had to pause it. I was like, I got to breathe. I put a play on. But no, that's not the norm in this TV series, but it was so effective, and it wasn't cheap or forced,
yeah.
I don't think. So,
and it ultimately brought the characters together. So it's like,
yes.
has like a very emotional weight to it, which is like, I think that's what he did with her. Almost all the jump scares, he like found a way to make them emotionally relevant.
Right.
Even if it's only in retrospect, like when you get to the episode about the bent neck lady, you finally find out who she is and you're like, oh, all those jump scares, or she never has jump scares. She just has really scary moments.
Yes.
And you're like, oh, now all of a sudden, if I were to rewatch those would all just be really sad.
Yeah. And, and it was like, I was like, whoa, this show just became a game changer.
Like
everything's off limits. Like here. I was like, well, that was a great twist.
Yeah.
I thought it's like, where are we going from here? And how he did it. And I wonder if it would have been different or as good if they had a different director each episode.
Like, and having done like a little bit of television, I feel that now that we're entering this premium TV landscape, these shows need that. They need that cohesive vision. And the crews and the cast needs that as well. So you do like one episode and then you leave. The cast has to like spend like a couple days getting used to the next director. And at a certain point, autopilot sets in because you're just changing guards so often. So I think it would have been good. Like, we've seen plenty of good shows that have employed multiple directors, but it wouldn't have been as good.
Right.
Or as cohesive.
Right, yeah. And that's what, perfect word, cohesive. Like, it just, every episode just seemed to go off the other and answer more questions and then promote more. I loved it. Preston, I know you watched it. What do you think?
Yeah, I didn't watch it when it came out right away. So I watched it this whole weekend and finished the last episode this morning.
So it's fresh on your mind.
Yeah. Yeah, I was a bit of an emotional wreck. I've realized that some of my favorite movies are related to family in some aspect, or being scared of putting your kid out there in the world. And so I'm some of my favorite podcasts, actually one of my favorite podcasts, slash film podcasts. They talk about how watching Interstellar before you have a kid and then after you have a kid. And I haven't done that yet, but I've noticed that a lot of the films that I'm gravitating more towards involve something about raising a child, or just that fear of not being able to protect them. And so a big component of this entire series involved that very thing. And just the whole idea of like a family just kind of dealing with trauma that the way that they do. And especially by the end, once you get to probably about the 9th episode, which was probably my favorite on a technical level, I mean, 6. So a lot of people talk about that because of the camera work. And to talk more about that, like, I don't think that because I think they did it in like 4 shots.
Right.
4 to 6, somewhere in there. Yeah.
Yeah. That it's not like a gimmick or anything like that. Like, that whole idea is to, you know, connect the past with the present.
You forget that they're not cutting. Like the first shot, I remember realizing
there's
a
chandelier on the
first
ground.
Cut is when the chandelier falls. But at a certain point, you just get caught up in the drama and whatever the subconscious effect of it being a continual shot is, certainly that's still working, but you're not sitting there just paying attention to the showmanship of the craft. You're actually so caught up in the drama. And that's one of the things that really impresses me when you have a gimmick like that. Mm-hmm. That is a gimmick, because everyone's like, oh, you gotta see this, it's one shot or it's 6 shots or however many shots it is. It is incredibly technically impressive, but you're never thinking about how they did it when you're watching it. Afterwards, I'm like, oh wow, how did they do that? But in the moment, you're so caught up in the story, and that's what you always want with those type of things.
Now, is that something very difficult to do? Like a one shot type of like a
far. I mean, what they were doing there is super difficult. Like it's daunting to think about. And he went on on Twitter and described how they did it and how many takes each shot took and all the different technical challenges they had and just the way it was executed. And it is just mind bogglingly difficult. But then the plus side, he was like, yeah. And then it took 10 seconds to edit the entire episode. which is I don't know if you saw that movie Victoria that came out a couple years ago. That is, it's like 2 hours and 20 minutes, and it's like a bank robbery thriller that's all one shot. And that's another one where you go into it, everyone says this is a great one shot movie, so you think it's a gimmick. And then like 40 minutes in, I just had completely forgotten that the camera had never cut. And if there were cuts in the movie, you could tell me that and be like, I don't care. Like, it doesn't change how good the movie is.
I miss this movie. I remember a film called Running Time with Bruce Campbell, and it was made all in one shot, and he gets out of jail and goes rob a bank.
I guess it's a good concept for one take thing because there's an inherent ticking clock to it.
Oh, I need to see that.
Victoria's great. And actually, it's not, the bank robbery is like the most minimal part of it. It's everything around and after it.
Okay.
Yeah, it played at Fantastic Fest back in like 2014, maybe?
Oh, I guess I missed that.
Yeah. It was really interesting. I talked to the director about it, and he said that I think they shot it like 16 times. I could be getting it confused with Locke because they did the same thing a little bit, but they used 3 different angles. But he had talked about, like, because there's like maybe 3 or 4 different locations, but they
because they there's like moments in the film where they go on the street, they have to improvise a lot based on whatever situation that they're dealt. If somebody like gets in their way, that they have to go around that and treat it like a play on wheels kind of thing.
And it's all timed to like the time of day, because the sunrise is a very key point in the movie. So it's all based on, you know, the very real fact the sun's going to rise at a certain point. They need to be a certain point to capture that drama that's happening at sunrise.
Okay.
And it works beautifully.
Really great.
And it worked perfectly in Haunting of Hill House.
Go back to that.
And I love, like, because I haven't read the book yet, but going off the original Haunting, like the same characters and kind of like the...
Same names
and the creepy statues that you kind of see, but like I guess in the TV show, they're just like super creepy. You're waiting for them to like move their head, but they never
do. Which is great. I'm really glad they didn't.
That's what I really like about Mike Flanagan, is he always kind of plays with the cliches of the genre in some way. Like you're expecting one thing, it ends up being another. I was really apprehensive about diving into this because after watching the Conjuring films and The Nun, we've kind of, you and I have analyzed these and picked them apart to death at this point, where you kind of expect, you know, the flashlight not working at the worst time.
The cat jumping out on you.
Yeah, and that kind of stuff. And the way that he plays with it is way more than I was expecting. It makes it even more fun to experience.
I did too. And I mean, I'm sure a lot of people seen this, but one of the big reveals in the TV show was the red door room.
Yeah.
Now, did you like there's the package. Dog. Yeah, the package. What did you think about that, the reveal? Or did you predict it, or did you know, like, so every character in the film like had a significance with that room, but they didn't reveal it until the end.
I liked it in theory. It didn't, like, to be honest, like, the last episode, like, is not my favorite. I think it's great. Like, it's emotionally satisfying, but it doesn't all, like,
it's got a lot
it
of...
doesn't hit the heights of the previous ones, and that's fine. Like, I don't need, you know, these things to always stick the landing. Mm-hmm. I think it does stick the landing. It doesn't, on a logical level, satisfy me completely, and I'm not asking for, like, complete logic when you're definitely breaking the rules of time and space, but it definitely was going more for an emotional payoff than anything else. And on that level, it definitely functioned, but it wasn't, it felt a little easy, to be honest. Yeah. It felt a little easy to me. And there were certain things I realized I just didn't need the movie to have, the show to have. Like, I didn't need...
All the back exposition.
Yeah, I didn't need Abigail, to be honest. Like, that was not a character who ultimately mattered. It was like a red herring to add an additional layer of fear early on in the film, or in the series, but it doesn't really matter that much, although it gave my buddy Robert Longstreet some opportunities to do some really good acting and monologuing. As the groundskeeper. It's sort of irrelevant. Like, I've already sort of forgotten the last episode because it ties things up. But as far as the story being told, I didn't need to be tied up. And so I sort of, like, have just set the ending aside. And, yes, I was emotionally satisfied. I was very moved. But what really mattered to me was getting there. So probably, you know, episodes 6 through 9 were the high point of the series for me.
Yeah, it was good. One thing that I wonder if y'all felt the same way when they were going back and forth from the kids to the adults, I couldn't understand why they didn't use Henry Thomas for the whole thing. I was like, I wanted more Henry Thomas, and I like, is it Timothy Hutton?
But they look so similar. I was like, wow, this is incredible. Like now Henry Thomas knows what he's going to look like in 30 years.
Yeah. No,
it was really remarkable for me. And I thought they both gave great performances. So
they did, yeah.
And we talked about this before we recorded, but so at the very end of the film where you see the very old version of him, where he's like white hair, white beard, is that Timothy Hutton or is that Henry Thomas?
I was trying to remember because they really did look so similar.
I really thought it was Henry Thomas.
Yeah, I'm trying
to know.
Wait, you mean when he carries, Are you talking about
the very end of the film where they're like in the room and then he's holding her and he has like a
that's
white
the groundskeeper.
Hair. Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, the groundskeeper with who brings in his dying wife. Yes.
That's
yes.
right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So you watched it all back to back. So.
So yeah. Okay. Yes, and that's kind of when you see kind of like where they say like this house was born of evil, but it's also. We can be here and
the tweak on the line, like the tweak on the, and those who walk there walk
right
together as opposed to alone, which is hopping in. It's like, oh, that's very sweet. Like that gets you on an almost Spielbergian, like emotional level.
Right. And he did it well. Like I like how like they wrapped it up, but I mean, this show's done so well, I think for Netflix, I cannot see them not doing a sequel. But they kind of alluded to like, oh, well, we see all these other, you know, entities in this house. Where will they go from here? Or will they bring back somebody else?
I mean, I think that, I mean, Mike Flanagan said that the Crane story is over, and I'm happy with that. Like, I don't think, yes, I'm very invested in their story, but I'm glad it came to a good ending.
Right.
So I think that it's...
we don't need a universe The Conjuring.
Yeah, exactly. I don't need to know more about the, like, tall man who, like, floats and taps his cane. Like, he's there to provide, you know, this the necessary amount of spookiness, but I have no burning desire to find out how he got into that house. But I do think you could continue to tell stories there, sure. Like, that's absolutely... It'd be fun to go do something where you're not... cutting back and forth in time, you're just doing a contemporaneous, like, scare the shit out of you version in that same set. That'd be really cool.
How did you feel about the way that they cut back and forth in time? Because I know you and I have talked about, you'll be invested in one moment and then pulled out of it and then feel frustrated as an audience member that you're like, no, I wanted to stay there. But the way that they do it in this film with lines of dialogue or certain images to kind of have that smooth transition.
I was always impressed because it implied that it was so carefully written that all of those things had to work. They couldn't change them. And, you know, that's in my movies when I've cut back and forth in time, it's usually like I'm discovering it in the edit and I'm, you know, sometimes it's written, but these were all so specifically written that it just is a testament to how good the scripts were from the get-go. And it also was nice because it often, you know, they'd be setting up something really scary to happen, and then they'd cut to another time period. You're like, save me from one more jump scare. And one of the things I love about the show, especially in the early episodes, was how they would just describe something truly terrifying. Like the woman describing her husband on the ceiling above her.
Yeah.
Or the kid who's been seeing his grandmother. And, like, the descriptions are terrifying, and they're setting you up to think you're going to see it at some point. And you never do. But they've already instilled so much dread in you just by the descriptions and by holding on these actors, giving these incredible performances, describing something that is so truly terrifying. It's really smart filmmaking. It really puts you at, you know, it makes you feel that unease from the get-go.
Yeah, and I wonder if, like, even more networks or streaming services are going to go this route in the horror genre.
I don't know. I've never watched, like, American Horror Story. I've seen a couple episodes here and there. I've never seen, like, anything like this.
Yeah, me neither.
Episodic. And I'm sure, I mean, people love it, so I'm sure there will be more.
Yeah, I hope so.
if audiences love something, that's a surefire sign that you're going to get more of it in some shape, way, or form.
That's good. Is there anything else you want to add?
Was there an episode that you didn't like?
I mean, the closest would be the last one. And it's just because it was sort of, like, emotionally irrelevant to me. Like, it was satisfying on the one level, but on the other hand, like, I didn't... I think, actually, Timothy Hutton's journey in that episode is the most important. The rest of the family, you know, all finding their bits of closure in that room together... I can take it or leave it, but Timothy Hutton's / Henry Thomas's, you know, journey towards death is really beautiful. And the reveal of what actually happened to him there, is really, really lovely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I asked because it's an issue that I've taken a lot with a lot of film series or TV series today.
There's too many episodes.
There'll be 10 episodes and I was like, oh, it only needed 6 or 8, to tell the story. And I don't know if it has
that's
to do
why
with...
I don't watch much. I mean, I don't watch much that's episodic because of that. And I just feel that bloat and I don't like it. it yeah. really just annoys me. And the idea that you have to fit it into this 10-episode box because that's the number of episodes you need to sell it to foreign markets, it's so annoying. And so it takes a lot for me to actually make it through an entire series. Like 30-minute episodes are different. Like Atlanta, yeah. great. Bay Area, great. But if it's an hour-long show, I feel like usually 10 or 13 episodes are too long. Like Westworld, I only made it through like 5 episodes. I'm like, I kind of see where it's going. And I feel it. You feel the wheels spinning. And with this one, maybe I was being generous because that's a genre I love, but I never really felt that at all. I felt like every episode justified its length, and I was actually happier when some of them were a little longer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. Because Westworld's kind of hard to get through. Even though I like the show, it's very difficult because there's so much going on. Like something like The Wire that's like even like simpler, or like even like if they're doing like BBC-style shows, like 6 episodes or 4 episodes, I tend to like really love that because I think it leaves all the filler out. Because that's why it's so hard to get through Walking Dead these days, is when are we getting to like the next big thing?
You can just tell when they're doing a reversal to keep things going, or adding something to keep things going. You just really... Like, we're very aware of it now, mm-hmm. and I don't like it. I've never loved a show enough to forgive it that.
Right. All right. I get it. Ah.
That's why they should all be 3 seasons long at max.
Yes, again, you run into, like, X-Files territory where, like, oh.
You have to justify, correct. Like, find some justification to keep going.
I call it, we were talking about it last week. I call it Harry Potterism, where you like, it's hard to believe that Harry Potter would, save the world 7 times, but.
It only during like middle school and high school.
Yeah. I'm a Harry Potter nerd, so I'll forgive it.
I love Harry. They're all out here. I love Harry Potter.
Change it. I'll make it a Sandwich Wiki from Transformers.
There you go. Yeah.
Perfect.
Did you finish your Hogwarts?
No, I'm barely like past the ground floor. It's a big set.
Harry Potter, what?
Lego set.
You're doing the Lego set of Harry Potter?
The new Hogwarts that just came out.
Okay, all right. Really How many pieces is that?
It's like 7,000, I think. Ugh. A little smaller than the Millennium Falcon that I built earlier this summer.
How was that?
Amazing. That was like the high point of my summer. Building this Millennium Falcon.
Have you? Because there's a Death Star Lego one and a Simpsons House one too.
Oh, the Simpsons House would be cool. The Death Star one, I just don't like the way it looks.
Okay.
Like, I just don't enjoy looking at it. So like the thing for me is to build something that's really fun to build and then have something aesthetically appealing to put on your shelf afterwards. And for some reason, the Death Star just like, even like in the Spider-Man Homecoming trailer when he has it and he drops, I'm like, I don't like the way that Death Star looks.
So the Hogwarts Lego thing, is it like the whole castle and everything?
It's everything, yeah. Oh. It's got all like the little, it's got like the chamber from Chamber of Secrets with the snake in it. And like that's the first thing you build because it's in the basement. And then I just finished the Grand Hall and gradually it's going to build up and get bigger.
That's badass. Now, do you keep them like displayed?
I just started doing this summer, so
okay.
I need to find a place to put them. Right now, my office, which we moved in this house a year ago, and I just have my desk and a computer in it, and that's it. And now the floor is just completely covered in like Lego pieces as I put these sets together, and I need to get like a shelf or something.
Have you stepped on a Lego yet?
Oh, easily, yeah.
Seems like it should come with like a photo album because I don't know how easy it is to. Because you were talking about the Chamber of Secrets, is it easy to like take the roof off so you can be like, these are all the little details?
Easy. Like with the Millennium Falcon, it's not easy. It's easy to take the pieces off to see all the details. Like because inside, it's like insanely detailed. It's got the little compartments that they hide in, the smuggling compartments. It's got the chessboard, and it's easy to take the panels off to see them. Putting them back on is a little trickier. And with Hogwarts, it looks like. It opens up. It's like hinged. So I think it'll be pretty easy to see everything.
Imagine all the paintings or the... Is it the Great Hall where they eat?
Yeah, that's, yeah exactly.
That's great. That's cool. Now I want to play Legos now.
I realized this summer, like, I was like, I liked Legos when I was a kid. I'm sure I would still like them now. And I just need something to do. You know, like I need like a hobby. So I chose that. And it's been great.
That is good. Well, I think that ends our episode of My Bloody Podcast. David, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. I love talking my favorite genre.
Yeah, I hope you come back again for another edition, another episode down the line. Preston, do we have anything for next week? Should we tease anything for next week?
I don't have anything.
We'll save it. All right. Where can they find you, sir? Online?
You can find me on Twitter at Preston Barta, B-A-R-T-A. You can also find me on Instagram, where I'm posting movie of the week kind of thing. And you can find my writing on Ditton Record Chronicle, DittonRC.com. And I'm the features editor of Fresh Fiction TV. So I'm posting a bunch of stuff there. So what's this week? This week is Overlord. So I have interviews with the director and the cast online right now on YouTube. And just put out a review today. So, yeah.
Nazi zombies. And I'm Brian Kluger. This is the Multimedia Men Podcast Network, iTunes and Stitcher Radio. You can find me at High Def Digest and Boomstick Comics. And David, do you want to be found on the big wide world web?
I'm on Instagram.
Okay.
Do some casual digging. It's easy to find me.
There you go. But yeah. My Bloody Podcast will be back with some fun horror films next week, but till then, watch The Haunting 1963 version, and if you can stomach it, the 1999 version, followed by the Netflix TV series.
I don't want to watch it.
Oh, I guess, or don't watch it.
I mean, if it was on cable, maybe I'd watch it.
Would you put it in a Liam Neeson marathon at all?
He dies pretty early on, if I recall. I mean, I put it in a Lily Taylor marathon, but she instantly just trumped it by doing The Conjuring,
right,
which is so much better. But she's always good. Owen Wilson gets his head bit off by a fireplace. I guess that.
Oh, I forgot Owen Wilson was in that. So, yeah, the Haunting, 1963, that's the one to watch. So we'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.